Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good morning and welcome to Unlimited Realities with Lisa Zimmer. I am your host, Lisa Zimmer, and today I'm very excited to present a very wise doctor for our listening pleasure and very informative, an innovator on the subject of ADD and ADHD, and Dr. Kevin Ross Emery has written a new book, and it's called Managing the Gift of Your ADD-HD Child. And Dr. Emery is, or Dr. Kevin, as he'd like to be referred to, is a wonderful pioneer who is taking this topic and making it mainstream. So it's not something we have to shove under the rug or be embarrassed by, because there's so many people walking around with slight or exaggerated states of this uninformed kind of situation. So without further ado, because I don't know too much about it, I'm bringing the expert on, Dr. Kevin Ross Emery. Thank you so much for being on Unlimited Realities today. Welcome.
Well, I'm glad to be here, Lisa. Thank you for having me. You know, and it's interesting because one of the things that you said right at the onset was, you know, you referred to the kind of confusion that people seem to be having. And
yes,
this varying degrees of what we call ADDHD. And so if you'd like, we can start there. How's that?
Let's definitely start from the beginning, because let's define for the audience what the difference between ADD and ADHD is.
Okay. And I'm going to give you one other one, because if you noticed in the title of my book, I talk about it as managing the gift of your ADDHD child.
Yes.
And so I have a third set of letters in there just to make sure we're all thoroughly confused.
Great. Wonderful. It makes that brain just bubble up with information. I'm all for that. So the floor is yours.
Okay. Well, the first thing is that what we want to do is we do want to understand a little bit of the history of ADD, which is, you know, in a traditional medicine science type perspective, there were notations about these children who seem to have a hard time fitting in, doing well in traditional classrooms, that were oddballs. They were
right.
out, you know, they just didn't seem like anyone else. And it goes back to the early 1900s with some of the first early notations on it, of them trying to figure out
What
was going on, which actually parallels my view of ADD, ADHD, and kind of the history of it. But I'm going to stay with the traditional history. So, you know, it was just here and there. There were these notations. There were these ideas. But things were still pretty loose. You know, public education was fairly new for the masses. I don't know if you know this or not, but the public education system was kind of based on the conveyor belt system that was so popular, you know, in the factories of the late 1800s. I actually had a school superintendent who had a doctorate in education, and he was a superintendent of schools, that in a conversation with me, and this was over 10 years ago, said to me, you have to understand that, you know, this is where the model came from. And we put all these kids, it's on like a conveyor belt. And as long as more stay on than fall off, we are being successful.
Wow.
Okay. And that education system that was originally created was created, you know, for kids coming off the farm or kids coming from, you know, as time went on, kids that came in that may not even had English as a first language speaking at home. It was a very rudimentary system. It was really reading, writing, arithmetic. I mean,
okay.
It was supposed to be giving the basic life skills to young adults, because they were leaving the farms, they were going into cities, we were having, you know, a need for a different kind of worker. There was all sorts of things that created that early education system. And you know, it was only the very wealthy and the very intelligent that, you know, if they were very intelligent, if they found, you know, sponsors, if they found mentors, that ever even considered going as far today as we would consider high school, let alone college.
Wow.
So, you know, a lot of these kids early on, these early ADD, HD individuals, didn't stand out quite so much, you know, because we didn't have the rigid, inflexible, in many ways inflexible, system of public education that we have now.
Okay.
And as that institution grew, it does what all institutions do, which at some point it is that the institution becomes self-preservationist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you can follow the history of almost any institution, from public education to our government to the churches, religions, you name it.
Right.
That what happens at some point is it loses its number one mission to be to serve the purpose of the institution. Its number one goal is to survive.
Right, control and survive, right.
Control and survive, and that's what it's here to do. And the longer an institution exists, historically, the more rigid it becomes until we have the rise and fall of whatever empire you want to call it, because institutions become like mini-empires sooner or later.
Right.
Yeah, well, and we're experiencing a lot of that right now in this
right,
country.
Right, right. Now, in regard to the ADD and ADHD child, because like you're saying, we've built a society based upon a stringent, kind of inflexible educational system, and it's, you know, point A, point B. It's very regimented. It's very black and white. The ADD and ADHD and ADDHD child is much more complex and usually, you know, a higher intelligence. Is that correct?
We are talking about very bright, highly intelligent, highly creative, and naturally rebellious children.
Right.
Adults.
Okay.
They, you know, some people think outside the box. They live outside the box, and they have to look back and squint their eyes to see what the box line looks like.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, that's great.
Okay. So, I mean, part of the reason is, I'm going to try to do this as quickly and efficiently as possible to understand both the labels, how they came about, what we're doing to these children now, and why it's an outrage. You have to understand a little of the historical perspective. So I do want to just kind of say that,
sure.
You know, as we were moving forward, we moved forward into the 1950s, and right after World War II, everything had to be perfect and everything had to be able to be presented on this little black box that started to take over our life called television. And we suddenly had the images of what it was to be a perfect wife, a perfect husband, a perfect child, have a perfect life. You know, every hair in place, the crinoline was always pressed, the suit was always immaculate, the struggle was always resolved in a half an hour or an hour.
Right.
And everybody loved everybody at the end.
Right.
Okay.
Great analogy, yes. Very good.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, what happens is, you know, by the last half of the 20th century, we're creating characterizations of what we think we're supposed to be. And we're seeing this play out on all sorts of ways. I mean, it's at the root of the increase in bullying. It's at the root of all of these eating disorders that kids, that children and adults have, and all these image issues and all of these other issues are based on this little black box, which now you can get in a 77-inch screen so that you can sit there and go through 249 channels 24 hours a day and never have to get off your couch. Hey, we create IV drips. Someone has a perfect life.
Right, right.
Living somebody else's life. So now we have these kids come back. They're bright. They're curious. They live outside the box. They question, they experience the world differently, and they don't do well with inflexibility. And the institution that has been created has become more rigid, more and more rigid. I mean, the height of rigidity is standardized testing and no child is left behind, which I think should have been called every child left behind, but that's just my opinion. every gifted educator I've ever talked to's opinion.
Right.
So, you know, because we keep on trying to push some part of them into this box. Now, in the strictest form, ADD was attention deficit disorder. It was a child who daydreamed, couldn't pay attention, didn't do well on testing oftentimes, would ask, you know, would blurt out questions, wouldn't wait for answer, the sentences to be finished, and they would blurt out the answers, or they would be lost. They seemed to have memory issues. And they just didn't conform well. And as you know, Lisa, this is my second book on ADD. My first one's called Managing the Gift, Alternative Approaches to Attention Deficit Disorder. And that came out in 2000. And at that point, I said, you know, as we were looking at this huge increase in medication, which has only gotten worse since 2000, I said, you know, we shouldn't have called it ADD. We should have called it CIS, which is Cultural Inconvenience Syndrome.
Ah, oh, genius.
Because for a lot of these kids, the problem was really was that they were being culturally inconvenient. Now,
right.
What I want to drop in at this point is when I first, you know, had these children and adults, and, you know, I was here running a full-time alternative practice doing coaching and counseling and this kind of seamless, I call it a seamless merge. I think if for any of your listeners out there that are Glee fans, a mashup. I had a mashup of coaching and counseling that I had created in my practice years before. And so I had actually within 4 or 5 days brought in an ADDHD adult and an ADDHD child that both needed help. I didn't mean to bring them in. I mean, they just showed up on my practice door, which kind of introduced me into that. So early on when I started getting very outraged at what was happening,
right.
And I could see the hand of lots of money to be made, and I was having visions of kind of, you know, that this was going to end up to be, you know, in 2050 or 2070, we're going to be, you know, you're suddenly going to see all of these apology letters and all of these lawsuits from the pharmaceutical companies settling, that the tobacco companies were settling as this was going on because of all of the hoodwinking that they were pulling about tobacco and cigarettes.
Okay.
I could see the parallel of what was happening. Misrepresentation of information, partial representation of information, controlling of the purse string dollar, huge, obscene amounts of money spent in lobbying and advertising and representation. And it's only gotten worse.
Right.
And so one of the things I discovered is that do you remember, Lisa, when we had what we call a gifted child program?
Yes.
That started, there were a few of them around, but there was a big push for them when America's standing in the educational world started to fall.
Right.
And so we said, we're going to look at these gifted children. They're going to have the best teachers, the smallest classroom. There's only going to be 6 or 8 or 10. And we're going to take 1% of the kids and they're going to make the other 99% that maybe we might want to look at the educational system was in a different way than in a Band-Aid
mm-hmm.
perspective. We're going to take these 1% and we're going to make them carry the weight of the other 99% doing so poorly.
Mm-hmm.
And they created a list, 10 items that they sent out that said, if you have children that are like this, then they may be eligible for the gifted program. Well, gifted programs didn't do so well. They needed funding.
Mm-hmm.
And as America became more apathetic, it also became more myopic. And it stopped really seeing the importance of investing in its future. Also, I can understand that because in some ways it was invested in a system that was already clearly showing it was broken. But there was a very self-centered selfishness around really supporting education the way it needed to be supported. And so what happened is the gifted program kind of limped along, and then it fell out of service because it needed funding and it needed a whole set of requirements. And a few years later, we now have circulated out, here's a list of 10 criteria, and if you look at these 10 criteria, you will find, you know, you may be dealing with a child who is ADD, that we are now identifying as this attention issue, and may need special help, and obviously at that time there were medications showing up to help these children. When I do this presentation live, I actually have a slide, or had a slide. I lost it in a computer crash. I'm trying to re-grab it.
Oh, no.
Which shows the two lists. Lisa, the lists are identical.
Wow. Okay. That's interesting.
Identical,
so
yes.
So basically, they didn't want to address the root of the problem. They wanted to mask it over and create something out of that in the gifted program.
Well, yeah, now we couldn't afford gifted programs. What we could afford is drug companies that would pay, you know, reputable people to go out and do in-services about how to convince your parents that, how to convince the parents that medication was the best option for their child.
Okay.
We can't afford the grade level of education you deserve, the small classroom, the great cutting-edge teacher, the latest technology. So what we'll do is we'll give you a pill, which, you know, for a long time I called the drug them up and dumb them down pill.
Right, exactly.
And now we have...
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, then we have, where does the H come in? You know?
Hyperactivity.
Well, so these are the kids that aren't just the daydreamers, that don't have just some impulsivity, but these are the kids that are more acting out. They're melting down. They are, you know what? Let's just face it. All children should just be thrown into the volcano if they cannot sit there for 8 hours with their hands folded on their lap, their feet flat on the ground. You know, every 1950 show told us the kids are capable of doing this. And heaven forbid we have a child fidget, act up, and say, you know what? I'm 6 years old. I don't want to sit down for 8 hours or 6 hours. I don't want
right.
to be bored. You know, I want to be wildly creative. I want to be curious. I want to take the world and actually explore it by touching it, feeling, and interacting with it. No. Bad children. Into the volcano. Right now.
So what do we do with them? What, besides medication, what do we do with these kids? I mean, you know, we need pioneers like you to bring the word out so that they have hope, so that they know that there's an alternative, that they don't have to be drugged and medicated.
So, well, the story gets better. And again, I'm trying to run through this as quickly as, you know, you have to understand, I do 6 hour, 8 hour workshops and theories on this and books and stuff. It's always interesting
right,
on our radio.
Right. We've only got an hour. So I want to make sure we hit what we need to hit in regard to, you know, there's just so much out there, and people are overwhelmed with not knowing where to go. I know they all need to buy your book, Managing the Gift of the ADD-HD Child. They, you know, where do we go from there?
Okay, well.
Go ahead. You can run with where you want to go with that.
Okay, yeah, well. One of the things is, and I am going to say, you know, also come to mydrkevin.com, sign up on my Facebook fan page. I am posting every day. I'm putting out 2 to 3 blogs a week. I'm constantly putting out either perspective or information or what I hope to be pearls of wisdom. So for your listeners out there, that's another source. Get my book. I also have a CD which has daily practices that these children and adults can actually listen to calm their energy, to focus, to take care of those emotional tantrums and breakdown, to actually learn how to move in the world in a way that the world doesn't overwhelm them. And I have all those exercises on a CD that I actually
Wonderful. Have
been buying for a dozen years. MyDrKevin.com, you can go and find it all. And it's also all, you know, Amazon, my new books on Kindle, Nook, you know. It is not hard to find, but it's out there. So, but one of the reasons I want to do, you know, I used to jump in right at the beginning and go, and this is how you should see it, and understand this is what it is, and then here are some techniques, and I'd throw out some breadcrumbs as fast as I can. But what I have found is that the PR and marketing campaign and educational campaign, you know, like, pharmaceuticals will pay people to go out and do in-services to teachers and counselors, literally on how to train parents, how to train counselors to work with parents on how to be more accepting and understand why they need to medicate their kids. And school systems have so little money that somebody says, we'll come and do a free in-services, and they have all of these credentials. They say, sure. But so one of the reasons why I have to pound through, if there's nothing else I walk out of this show doing, is changing people's perspective in a solid enough way that if you're a parent and you go into one of these meetings, you sit with one of these counselors that have been trained by the drug companies, you go out there up to your pediatrician, who only has access to the information that he's getting through the AMA and all that stuff, unless he has time or she has time, and a lot of them don't, to go explore all the alternatives. They will make you doubt, and I have to, this is why it's so important. I mean, and I'm going to go back, and I'm going to jump into my one of my punchlines right now. ADHD is part of the evolutionary process. It's been coming in since the 1850s. They were the architects of the 20th century. They were Alexander Graham Bell. They were Einstein. They were Edison. You know, they were Marconi. They gave us telephone, telegraph, the automobile, the assembly line. They gave us, you know, people ask me sometimes, did the ADHD, was it created by television, computers, internet, video games? No, the ADHD mind created television and computers and internet and video games. It created things to amuse them and to challenge them, take them to the next realm. And back to your opening statement, they are creating very slowly a more ADHD-friendly world, which is encouraging everybody to be a little bit more ADHD, a little bit more, I have to be able to multifocus, and I have to be able to be looking and working and doing several different things. I have to be expanding. And that word, expanding, these individuals are here to broaden the bandwidth of humanity. They're not here to replace the old model. They're just here to expand humanity and add a deeper richness to the texture of humanity by giving us things that humanity didn't have before, which is, i.e., the 20th century and now the 21st century. That's what they're here to do. If I can get your listeners to understand that, when they have to go out there, you know, they can get my book with tons of techniques, and I'm going to give you some. And they can follow my blogs, and they can. There's great things out there, and we'll go through a list. But if they, within their heart and soul, Lisa, don't really look at that child or look at themselves as an adult and say, "I don't have a disability. They don't have a disability." I teach them all right up front. You have a disability. You learn and process information differently. And 85 to 90% of my problems are being ADHD in a non-ADHD controlled world, i.e., the institutions. And if that is why I have taken more time now when I'm being interviewed to let people really understand why all of this has happened and all this information, because these poor parents, the first time they get the call to come in, they start getting inundated. They get inundated with brochures or information. They're questioning, what should they do? These are the experts. I'm supposed to be trusting these people. I want to do what's in the best interest of my child. They will say to you, and I've had it repeated back to me by people who have sat in meetings at schools and with counselors and with drug reps, interestingly. but they've sat there, Lisa, and then said, if your child was diabetic, wouldn't you give them insulin? How could you deny them if this is what's going to help them? It's not the same thing. And that's why it's so important. If we don't start at the foundation level, Lisa, you want to have me on in some other time? I'll come on for another hour. I mean, that's fine. But I have to start in the foundation of every listener walks out and say, hey, wait a second, this is a gift. This is an evolutionary process. And we have to help these children by teaching them how to be self-advocating, and they need to understand how they work, what works for them, what doesn't work for them. The H part of it came in because, yes, there was hyperactivity. My favorite word in talking about all of this is exacerbate. There are so many things there that will take that gifted ADHD child and exacerbate them into that monster nightmare that – suddenly we see on TV, on drug commercials, and in magazines that basically say to the parent, it has nothing to do with you. This is a neurological, this is simply a neurological, you know, illness or thing, and it can be corrected, and you are off the hook. And, you know, it doesn't make any difference if, you know, you work 80 hours a week and your kids started with daycare when they were 2 years old and, that they were calling their daycare teachers mommy and daddy because they couldn't tell the difference between you and them, and they're going into, you know, a school system where they're one of 30 kids in a classroom that the teacher can't even remember their name by midterm break because they're so overwhelmed with no support. That has nothing to do with it. It has nothing to do with that they're really bright and that they're bored. It has nothing to do with any of these things. You have no guilt here. Just give them this pill, and it's a magic pill, and the world is a better place. Who doesn't want to buy that when the alternative is these kids need a very structured diet? They need a good, clean diet because a bad diet exacerbates it. They need an environment that is friendly to their learning style, to their comprehension, that's set up in a way that their mind can move at the pace that it needs to, which is usually very quickly, but when it gets stopped, it gets a hard, dead stop, and you need to work it through. They're not just going to stop and take pieces of information on faith. They need to understand them. They need to learn critical thinking ways that need to be interactive, and they need to participate in everything from their own creation of household rules to how they take information in, how they do that. They take a great deal of time up front, but once you have them up and going, they can take off and do amazing things. Very little, or at all.
Well, that brings me to a question for you. In regard to dealing with that brain that can divert in so many different directions at once and is highly acute and intelligent and creative and all of these wonderful attributes that an ADD brain has, does it benefit the person who's suffering with ADD when they are instructed to do something, that there's a myriad of different ways we can present the instructional aspect of what needs to be done? If, for instance, the average person is given instruction verbally, they carry the task to completion. With an ADD brain, they're already thinking 15 different things in their thoughts, and so then they get an impulse or they get direction verbally. Would it not benefit them as well to have it both written down as well as verbally spoken to them so that they can kind of like have more organizational skills with their thinking and how they're aligning with task, with finishing completion? I ask this because this is something that I've started doing with a loved one, and it's worked phenomenally well. So, you know, I know that there's little things we can all do simply. Would that be something that you would advise in regard to working with instructions and tasks?
Okay. Well, the first thing is that it is working with this loved one of yours because they have they're a certain type of learner, processor. In the new book, one of the things is I have this whole section called Painting Your Child's Portrait. When you paint your child's portrait, and that child could be your spouse or a close friend or an actual child, but when you paint your child's portrait, when you paint the ADDHD person's portrait, and you understand really how they attach to information, how they process information, how they learn information, how they experience the world, then you start to find that there are ways to make things easier for them and easier for yourself. You have discovered one. You have what I call stumbled onto something that works very well for one of your loved ones. And for some ADDHD individuals, that will be the perfect solution. For others, that would not work as well. They're not magic solutions. And see, this is, I really look at one of the reasons that these kids are up, and they're up in our face, and they are challenging humanity. is because we went way overboard in trying to make one-size-fits-all everything. One-size-fits-all education, one-size-fits-all clothing, one-size-fits-all
right.
everything should be able to be bought on a drive-thru. What works, and this is where, in the book, when I start to break down all of these categories, and after you've painted your child's portrait, then I start to give you some things that will work depending on the different kind of tones and hues of that portrait. With what you're telling me, that this loved one of yours needing this support, they're writing it down, and so they're probably more highly visual than audio. And if they're writing it down, they're writing it down and they're committing it. When I was in school, I'm ADHD. Never been officially diagnosed. Never have been, nor never will be medicated. But I got through school by writing down the notes and then never looking at them again. All I had to do was write them down. Writing them down, the act of writing them down and putting them in my head and then playing with the information. How
okay.
old is this loved one?
15,
okay. So with this young man, one of the things is that not only if he writes it down, but if he kind of applies it, if he plays with the information, if he looks at the information and we get him to take the information, like you would take a ball of clay and sculpt something with it, how
mm-hmm.
would you use it, work with it? How would you make it better, or how would you explain it? You know, I actually create a whole different grading system in my new book. And it really talks about that we shouldn't just be grading on the ability to sit down and fill in a little, you know, like circle A, B, C, D, or do a matching set of lines, or even fill in the blank, or, you know, an essay. There really should be a, explain how what this information means in your world. Tell me about this information. But the actual, you know, I have for years called public education the vomit system of learning.
Mm-hmm.
You ram things down their throat, and if they vomit it up in the right order, then we pat them on the head, kick them on the backsides, and push them forward. There is no evidence that they actually know how to do anything with that information. There's no critical thinking skills being taught. And so I will find that consistently with all of these kids, anything that will engage critical thinking skills, that will make them attach the information in however they attach, and in this case, this young man attaches it better through writing, through being visual. But we could take that to another step. Once this ADHD mind becomes desirous of wanting to learn it, it finds value in it. Once it finds that it is actually curious, it will become self-motivated and driven. You see, the attention deficit part of it is a misnomer. It's not that they can't pay attention, Lisa. They either pay attention mm-hmm. or hyperfocus. If this young man is interested in something, he has no problem hyperfocusing on it.
Right.
It might be a video game, but his brain registers as a value to a video game. Where is there a value to learning a series of dates of something that happened 400 years ago that unless you want to, you know, be on Jeopardy, will never serve a purpose for him?
Well, she's very intelligent, and she comes from a family that's very aware of alternative approaches. So she's not coming from a place of, you know, being drugged by the typical society of this is how we deal with this. So her parents are very informed, but she is coming from a place of where, you know, when she was 7 or 8 years old, they had to put her on Wellbutrin because she, in seeing a therapist, they wanted to control she was the typical raising the hand and outbursts in the classroom, and things like that. Highly, highly intelligent, very, very creative, very right and left brain. But there's this piece of, like you were saying, every person's different, and there's a different map for every person, like the writing down or, you know, looking at notes may be different for her than somebody else. But you've got this at such a place where you're making this acceptable. And I think that, more than anything, is the hope that's needed within society, that this is not something to label an individual or a child. This is something that actually is a pulse vibing through so many and can really be channeled in a positive way.
Well,
that's
what I
love about your approach.
Yeah, well, and it is. You know, everything comes, if somebody is very, very right-brained, there's great things that they can do and great challenges they have. If somebody is very, very left-brained, there is great things they can do and great challenges they have.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, we reward mediocrity, which is a lot about, again, about how we've structured this conveyor belt system of education. And so because these kids are challenging, because that impulsivity, I mean, I'm sorry, there's a little part of me that cringes that thinks about putting a small child on Wellbutrin when it's like, okay,
right.
So they're a little impulsive. You know, first of all, let's face it, you know, they're showing over and over again. I was just watching something the other day, a presentation, where they do this thing where the intention will go up and stays level, but impulsivity with age goes away because as the brain continues to develop, it will self-adjust. So the question is it so life, you know, is it a life and death situation that a six-year-old may have not great, you know, control skills if in a year or two they'll outgrow it? Is there really
exactly.
a reason we have to put them on medication for 2 years to make the classroom easier for the teacher? I'd rather take them out.
Right.
I'd rather homeschool.
Right.
You know, send them to an alternative class. Do something else. But why medicate this poor body because there is some part of their brain that is not functioning quite, is not growing at the same rate? I mean, it's like saying, oh, look, you know, you should be, you know, 4'2" by the time you're in third grade or whatever. And if you're only 3'8", then we're gonna start shooting you up with medication so you'll grow faster. And if you're
right.
too tall, we're gonna bind your feet and put you in a corset so you'll slow down. I mean,
it's insanity.
I mean, it's the insanity of pushing these parents sometimes. There are no black hats here.
Right.
There are no black hats here. I have dealt with very gifted educators. I have dealt with very different, counselors and teachers and parents who are all struggling. If I had to assign the black hat, it would be on the institution itself, which doesn't allow it. I had a young man I was working with. We were having fabulous success. He literally came to my doorstep because his mother came to me and said, he said that if we medicate him and make him a zombie like his friends, he will run away from home. And I said, well, you know, we'll find you and have to bring you back. And he said, well, if you continue, I will kill myself. And she believed him. And so they brought him to me. I'm having some fabulous results with him.
I would take that seriously, too. That would scare me to death.
And the school system was like, he can't return if you don't medicate him. And so we're doing all of these things. And this is where I talk about, if I'm going to give a black hat, it's to the institution itself and no one individual. The counselor that worked with him called me one day at school, from school called me and said, I don't know what you're doing with this young man, but it's really helping. Is there anything that you can share with me, anything that can help, that you can give me to help him so I can, you know, keep it going at school or whatever? And we talked for, I don't know, 45 minutes or an hour, talked about some different things. And at the end of the phone call, she said, but I never called you. If anyone ever found out I ever called and talked to you, I'd lose my job.
Wow. Wow.
Because I take an alternative,
right.
approach to things.
Right.
And, you know, whether they work or not are irrelevant. I haven't jumped the hoops of the institution, even though I actually have gone in and done in-services for school systems. I've had school systems come in and have me do in-services for their teachers about how to help these kids in the classroom. So, you know, when we look at some of these issues, the first thing, again, is understanding it is an evolutionary process. Also, do understand, and I do want to communicate this, that the ADDHD, and the reason I call it that is there started to be a huge questioning, Lisa, of do we really need to medicate the ADD kids? Because the ADHD kids are the ones that were acting out. Now, I have never worked a full program with an ADHD child and parent, set of parents, that if they didn't really follow and adopt and work with, that the H just became high energy and not hyperactivity. Again, diet, environment, setting up certain things, putting certain things in place can make all the difference in the world. But it takes more time and energy up front to structure these things and to fight for them to make sure that they happen and to know the laws and know your rights as a parent and understand that the school system is torn and it's broken and it's underfunded. And some of the things you're going to ask for, they're going to say they can't do, but by law they have to. I mean, it's horrible things we do to our educators these days. I mean, we put them in no-win situations all the time. But, you know, what happened is there was an outrage because of this fastly growing number of kids that were being diagnosed and these kids that were being medicated. And so as they questioned it, they said, well, you know, we're not sure that, you know, first of all, these children under the age of 8 should not be being medicated, according to the physician's desk reference, what we call the physician's, you know, like guidelines. I call it the physician's Bible on, you know, medicating and things like that and diagnostic codes. But, you know, so they said, we're not going to do, you know, they shouldn't be under the age of 8. We shouldn't be given any type of medications because we have no idea what kind of long-term effect they're going to have. And, you know, and then there was an outcry of, should we really need to medicate them because they're daydreamers, because they're not paying attention. So maybe they're not doing so well on their test scores or stuff like that. They're obviously very clearly bright kids. There were some voice of reasons that were questioning all of this increase in medication. So the next physician's desk reference that came out, read of the diagnosis of ADD as a single diagnosis, and they made the diagnosis ADHD, because ADHD diagnoses could get medicated. So now you have an ADHD diagnosis with a subcategory of ADD. So you have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder with non-hyperactivity component, i.e. ADD. But because it's now listed as ADHD, it can be medicated. So it was a political game. It was a money game. It was a game so that scripts should be written when people were questioning whether scripts should be written for a certain kind of ADD at all. They just created it in a category that they could still get away with writing scripts. Between 1995 and the year 2000, there was a 400% increase in Ritalin prescriptions for 2 to 4 year olds.
That's sad.
And the double-digit growth, the amount of kids that are being medicated now, and again, it's all a language game. It's a coding game. All of these things are going on. And we have to really, and we have to be able to look at these children and know that we as parents, as their guides and their support systems, are here to fight for them because they're here to destroy the institutions that no longer work and replace them with something that will work better. They are natural rebels. They are bright. They are creative. They are insistent. They are in our face. They are blunt. And they ask us questions that we are uncomfortable hearing.
Do you find that an ADD child has a parent who is also slightly or full-blown ADD? Is it a genetic component? Is there a genetic component with this?
Absolutely. I mean, and that's one of the things that comes out again and again is, you know, if you're looking at an evolutionary process, you're often going to find that it's going to show up in certain DNA gene pools. And, of course, they're going to increase. And then like any gene, sometimes they can become recessive and they can skip a generation. I've talked to people that can go back, they clearly go back three generations. They say, yep, grandpa was clearly what they would call grandpa ADD, and mom is, and now I am, and I've met all three generations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the funny thing is, you know, I actually didn't meet the grandfather in this particular one, but I was talking to an adult woman, and she had a child who was probably going to be ADD. Or she had a child that was probably going to be diagnosed as ADD.
Mm-hmm.
She could kind of see if she didn't fight this or whatever. And she already was really clear, you know. You know, this child was going to go to private schools, maybe be homeschooled, whatever. What are the options? They were talking to me about the options, which would have made a fourth generation. So, but we were talking
mm-hmm.
with the three. Like, yep, you know, crazy as a hoot owl. Everybody thought granddad was. Thought he was a self-made millionaire.
Right.
And here's a little piece of hope I want to give out to people, which is, you know, a few years back, I was actually flown to England for 6 weeks, and all I did was I was flown over by this man and a bunch of his friends, some who never finished university, some who didn't even finish what we would call, completely finish what we'd call high school, all who had ADD, all who were self-made millionaires.
Wonderful.
And the reason that they succeeded was because they had either really horrible support from parental structures, and they basically made him so angry that they succeeded despite those people that said that they would never succeed, or they had really
right.
great support.
Right.
Somehow, mediocre support doesn't seem to help. You know, there needs to be a consistent, you're never going to make anything of yourself, or a consistent, it's your world, create the world you want. I've been
right.
telling clients and students I teach. I have students, people who want to do what I do, and so I will teach private courses and classes, stuff like this. And I say one of the philosophies I've lived by my whole life is if there's not something in the world that I want the way that I want it, then I create it myself. You know, I
okay,
simply create
right.
it. You know, if the world doesn't have something you have that you want, create it.
And that takes a certain tenacity, inner worth. You know, like you said, it's either you've been supported or you haven't. And surely those, you know, are drawing from some element of support, whether it's one person or 15. There's something they're hearing that's resonating. And they're banking on their skills and their tenacity and their will and their drive and their passions and moving forward with it, as you have. And, you know, it's an incredible inspiration what you've been able to do and be an advocate for such a misunderstood group of individuals that apparently is growing at alarming rates, because we are all touched by this. If we don't know somebody or have somebody, maybe even we are, you know, affected. And there's also varying levels to it, right? I mean, like you were saying, there's different, you know, maps of methods of how to use alternative approaches in moving through this and managing this. But it's kind of like a scale in regard to how full-blown it is in regard to how you know, the triggers when it comes in. Is that correct?
Well, you know, you're born with it or you're not, and you never outgrow it. What
right.
happens is, you know, age can bring wisdom and self, you know, and self-managing techniques. Kids will, you know, stumble on something, or parents stumble on something, and then they grab onto it. The ADHD brain needs just enough structure to fly. Not enough, it can't get off the launch pad. Too much will actually destruct the structure. It's almost, it's claustrophobic to it. So when that ADD, you know, one of the things they do is I actually do business consulting as one of the arms of
okay.
my business. My first 12 years were spent in the corporate world. My first degrees were in business and psychology. And so I spent a long time in the corporate world, and now my tendency is if I'm working with a small to medium-sized company, it's because it has either an ADDHD key player or owner. And I'm going in and showing them how to create that just right amount of structure and then helping them learn how to communicate to their staff and the people they interact with what they need and how they need it for it to be most effective so that everyone can get what they need. Because oftentimes these individuals are brilliant and sometimes create one brilliant thing, which when they hyper-focus on, get out of their way. I call it the instant expert syndrome. They become fascinated about something, and, you know, within 3 to 4 weeks, they can be given a PhD dissertation, even if they're only 10 years old on it, because they hyper-focused and went just as deep and far as they could. And so they don't need any motivation, and they'll work 80 hours a week because they're driven by their passion and their desire to create that, whatever that widget is, or figure out that problem, or to see it from a different way, or to get something. And this is, again, these were the architects of the 20th century, just relentlessly driven by that need to discover, to know, to invent, to reinvent, to shift, to change, to whether it was in art, music, philosophy, spirituality, science, you know, you name it. In every conceivable field of humanity, we saw them start to come out. But in a less institutionally controlled world where there was more freedom and more Wild West energy still available, they could go off and be oddballs and loners and create these little lives where they did things that changed the whole shape of humanity, off in a little one-room, you know, room walk-up in New York City somewhere. But
right.
Now we've become so overruled and regulated. There are some states out there that if your child gets diagnosed, you get an official diagnosis, then they actually say you have to medicate that child to send them to school unless the school is willing to sign off of it. What right does a state have to tell you what your health care option should be, especially when there is still so much doubt about medication even being necessary or not? And we all know it has a ton of side effects.
Right.
Whether they happen or not. Why would you roll the dice? What right does a state have? Well, you know what? It manages the cost of education. Medicating these kids managed the cost of education. And it was on that, which is why states started to come in and mandate things like this, which at some point we're going to find are unconstitutional. Somebody's going to challenge it. And constitutionally, a state can't tell you have to medicate your child when it's not a life or death situation.
Good.
But, you
that
know,
would
the question
be,
is...
That, it, yeah. Who's going to adhere to those stipulations when there's so much control within the institutions to manage and control? Because it's going to take an advocate. It's going to take a group of advocates to really bring the, you know, information from a medical standpoint and the emotional standpoint and really make a difference that this is not something that's just easily swept under the rug. Because, it falls into the diagnosis of mental health disorders. And there's been such a – it's become such a dirty word for so many years and decades with people not wanting to talk about mental health disorders or ADD or bipolar or personality disorder or any of these conditions. And they're all kind of lumped into one when they're not. And so it's easier just to put the blindfold on for society within the institutions than to really address it one thing at a time and make some actual progression when we've got the pharmaceutical companies raking in billions on drugs, over-medicating our society. So God bless you for bringing this wisdom and alternative approaches and methods to our ears, to our hearts, to our parents, our caretakers, everyone who really wants to look at the alternative approaches here. We have about 4 minutes left of the show, and I want to make sure you address everything you want to address. So I'm going to be quiet now and let you take the floor for the next 4 minutes.
Okay, well, thank you. I felt like I've held the floor for most of the thing, which I appreciate you being willing to do that. There are a few things. The first thing I want you to understand, and again, I am going to climb back up on the soapbox. I have to one more time. Parents, spouses, people who are gifted with ADHD, just because you have not been able to touch or see all of those gifts in a way that suit your life does not mean it cannot happen. I am not a medical doctor. I cannot diagnose. I cannot prescribe. I cannot tell you to go off your medication. I'm not going to, that's not my purpose. I'm telling you that there are many things that are out there that can support you to live a functional life, which may mean you do not need to medicate, because there is always a little bit of loss in the medication. There's not quite as much creativity. There's not quite as much brilliance. There's just a little bit less color in that world, in that ADHD brain, when it's forced to take all of those wild pulses of thoughts and creativities and energies and bring them down. And if you can create that naturally, why not?
Mm-hmm.
Please remember it's an evolutionary process. Please remember that you are here with this great gift, and that you are among a group of great people that over the last 150 years has truly changed and shifted the way humanity functions. When you can recognize that that gift lies within you and you learn to nurture it and understand it, don't let other people make you hate it. Don't let other people make you disabled. Stand up and say, I need to understand my uniqueness. And there are so many things you can do. And please start with diet. Please start with some of the environmental issues. I have so much, so many things out there that can exacerbate that ADHD condition and create those nightmare stories about the ADHD child or adult, which, when we take away those exacerbating factors, comes down to that type A personality that just changes the world and changes everybody they touch, because they're just so passionate and so driven and so bright and so creative. And if there was ever a time that the world needed a bunch of saviors to come in and get our backsides out of some of these slings we're in, it's now.
Mm-hmm. Right. And amen to that, because you have a real approach here that is really going beyond just talking about, you know, how we got this point. In your book, you're actually providing tools and, you know, guidelines and inspiration for the parent and caretaker, for the child or individual who suffers with ADD or ADHD or ADDHD. And you also have a tremendous amount of insight and compassion listed with your mission. I mean, your whole sole purpose here is based upon a tremendous calling of passion for the misunderstood person. And this is something that maybe with the works of that you're able to provide and the insight and wisdom that you're providing us, that there's going to be more out there who latch on to your concept and develop more of an alternative approach as doctors, as therapists, as physicians, as counselors, to work within the parameters of the gifted creative soul, because they don't think like a normal left brain thinker. And the highly creative individual, the Mozarts, the artists of our world, the pioneers who have given us all of this incredible literature and paintings, and we have created a society that really wants to put the individual in a box. And I'm all about blasting the sides of the box down. So Dr. Kevin Ross Emery, thank you so much for being on Unlimited Realities today. And I want to direct everybody to your website. Again, it is healingthegift.com or managingthegift.com and drkevin.com. So you have two websites here.
It's mydrkevin.com, mydrkevin, mydrkevin.com. Sorry.
That's okay. mydrkevin.com and managingthegift.com. You can get a whole bunch of wealth of information and wisdom. You can schedule an appointment. You can talk to Dr. Kevin. Thank you so much for being on today, Kevin. This has been such an informative show and so necessary to speak out, to really get everybody on the same page that we don't have to be a medicated, dumbed-down society. Amen. God bless you and your mission, your purpose, your vision. I really, really support everything you can do. Let me know if there's anything else I can do. And we'll talk again because I think this is such a, an important topic.
Great. Well, thank you for having me.
My pleasure, Kevin. Have a wonderful holiday season, and God bless everybody. I'll talk to you all next week. Thank you for listening to Unlimited Realities. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye.